Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Continuing to read from presidential historian Michael Betschloss's Presidents of War and his essays on Lyndon Baines Johnson and the Vietnam War. We pick up the story with the run-up to deep American involvement in the Vietnam conflict in August of 1964 and following the attack by North Vietnamese gunboats on the USS destroyer Maddox, the House debates the resolution on whether or not to deepen the conflict in Vietnam. That afternoon, on August 6, 1964, the House of Representatives passed what was now widely called the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution by a vote of 414-0. The U.S. Senate endorsed the bill by a vote of 88-2. The resolution was opposed by Democrats Wayne Morris and Ernest Gruening, the latter of Alaska, who decried the document as merely a predated declaration of war power that properly belonged not to the president but to Congress. Senator Morris of Oregon deprecated the Tonkin Gulf incident as another sinking of the USS Maine, a deliberate pretext to justify making war against North Vietnam. Senator Gruening said he would not send our boys into combat in a war in which we have no business, which is not our war, into which we have been misguidedly drawn, which is steadily being escalated in private. Told about those two dissenters, President Johnson, who had wanted a unanimous endorsement from the Senate, complained that Senator Morris was undependable and erratic, and that Senator Gruening was worse than Morris, stating, "He's just no good. I've spent millions on him up in Alaska." The Tonkin Resolution achieved a short-term political purpose. In late August, at the Democratic Convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey, the keynote speaker, Senator John Pastor of Rhode Island, reminded the delegates that only 3 weeks ago in the Gulf of Tonkin, Hanoi and Peking felt the sting of President Johnson's determination. After Congress passed the resolution, Barry Goldwater of Arizona toned down his complaints about the issue, and for the remainder of the 1964 presidential campaign, Lyndon Johnson saw fit to mention the word in Vietnam in public only half a dozen times. Without a Tonkin Gulf-style mini-drama, President Johnson's resolution would never have passed the House or Senate so resoundingly. During debate, members would have demanded that Johnson and McNamara, his Secretary of Defense, reveal exactly what they planned to do in Vietnam. Instead, with almost no serious examination in the wake of a counterfeit, unprovoked attack against the United States, Congress hastily passed the president's own document intact. Both Johnson and his successor, Richard Nixon, used the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution as their warrant to prosecute a doomed war in Southeast Asia that, just as Senator Russell had privately warned the president, would consume the next decade in America. President Johnson proudly kept a copy of the resolution passed by Congress in his wallet throughout his presidency. While defending his military struggle in Vietnam, he would yank out the slip of paper and wave it at interlocutors. In February 1965, when Congress considered his first major escalation in Vietnam, the president told Secretary of State Dean Rusk, "I would keep those 502 congressmen right chained to me all the time with that resolution." McNamara was summoned to testify before Congress, and Johnson told him, "Bob, I think if you do run into any questions, you ought to say when we went into Korea, there was some question about the Congress not expressing themselves. And for that reason, last summer, we asked the Congress for a resolution. I read it last night again. We all said, we are not trying to seek any wider war, but here's what the Congress says. Now, anytime anybody asked me, I would say, now the commander-in-chief has certain inherent powers, but it so happens in this instance that Congress has expressed theirself very definitely, and so here's what it has said, period. During a private conversation that spring with George Mahone of Texas, the House Appropriations Chairman in Congress, President Johnson contended that he had leveled with Congress by asking for the resolution, stating, I've got a vote of confidence by a vote of 502-2. I thought this would be a master stroke with the Congress to show them I was frank and candid, and when I needed something, I would put it right in their belly. And if they gave it to me, why, they'd say, we can trust the guy. Although he's got authority, he didn't write his check. He let us in on it. If I hadn't been there 30 years on the Hill, I would have just signed the document that came to me transferring funds. So I laid my cards on the table. In 1969, back on the LBJ Ranch, after he left the White House, ex-President Johnson defended his decision to ask the House and Senate for the Tonkin Resolution document. During an interview with Walter Cronkite of CBS, Johnson explained with intense emotion, Congress gave us this authority to do whatever may be necessary. That's pretty far-reaching. That's the sky the limit. When Cronkite asked him why he had not asked the Senate and House for a full declaration of war, Johnson said, I didn't know what treaty China might have with North Vietnam or Russia might have with North Vietnam. The communists had these agreements among themselves. And if we declared war against North Vietnam, that might automatically declare war against China and bring them in, triggering the thing, or the Soviet Union as well. That same year, discussing his early decisions on Vietnam, Johnson told two members of his post-presidential staff, if you let a bully come in and chase you out of your front yard, tomorrow he'll be on your porch, and the next day he'll rape your wife in your own bed. In later decades, when Americans were more jaundiced against their leaders, many came to view the Gulf of Tonkin incident as a pretext deliberately produced by a president thirsting for war in a dishonorable tradition, extending from President Polk's provocative behavior in Mexico in the 19th century to whatever ledger demand some people thought Franklin Roosevelt might have been up to at Pearl Harbor. It was fortunate for Johnson that Americans of his own time did not learn that soon after Congress passed the Tonkin Resolution, Johnson was secretly informed that, thanks to further investigation by the Pentagon and U.S. intelligence, there was probably never any August 4th attack on the USS Maddox by the North Vietnamese gunboats. When he was told of this new finding, Johnson responded that he had already felt skeptical about the second assault on the destroyer. He said also in private to George Ball of the State Department, hell, those dumb, stupid sailors were just shooting at flying fish. After receiving the later evidence that the second enemy attack on the Maddox might have been a chimera, the president refused to take the political risk of informing Congress and the public that his information had been faulty. Certainly, he did not dream of asking the House or Senate to revise or retract the resolution that was based on that attack. In September 1964, Johnson privately showed his tough-minded attitude about the supposed second assault on the destroyer when Secretary of Defense McNamara telephoned him to report a possible new incident in the Gulf of Tonkin. The president replied to McNamara, now, Bob, I have found over the years that we see and we hear and we imagine a lot of things in the form of attacks and shots. I don't want them just being some change-of-life woman running up and saying, by God, she's being raped just because a man walks in the room. A man gets enough braid on him, and he walks in a room, and he just immediately concludes that he's being attacked. And then in a day or two more, we're sure it didn't happen at all. Johnson went on to remind Defense Secretary McNamara that on Tuesday morning, August 4th, 1964, McNamara had called him from the Pentagon and said, "Damn, they are launching an attack on us." And then when we got through with all the firing, we concluded maybe that they hadn't fired at all. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, J. William Fulbright, grew suspicious about the Gulf of Tonkin incident earlier than most of his colleagues. In January 1968, with more than 500,000 American fighting in Vietnam and Johnson's war by then a catastrophe, Fulbright ordered a secret study by his committee of whether the Tonkin Gulf episode had been a charade engineered by the president to push an unwitting country into conflict. Recalling that Johnson had framed the Tonkin resolution as a means of keeping out of war, not getting in, Fulbright now angrily said that if Americans had been told otherwise, they would have been shocked. About Johnson, who had once been his friend, Senator Fulbright now complained, "I was taken in." Fulbright and his foreign relations colleagues considered the secret study and their discussion of it sufficiently explosive that the transcripts of them were withheld from public view until the year 2010. The committee's longtime chief of staff, Carl Marcy, who had served under both parties, informed the senators that in August 1964, although he may not have deliberately lied, McNamara had missiled the committee in stating that the Navy was unaware of attacks on the South Vietnamese on North Vietnam. Frank Church, Democrat senator from Idaho, recalled that Johnson and McNamara had presented the August 4th incident as though the attack did in fact occur without any question. Senator Albert Gore of Tennessee chimed in, "and deliberate and unprovoked." "We were just plain lied to, just in so many words," said Senator Fulbright. "I don't think they told us the truth." The Arkansan expressed his fear that the United States had lost a form of democracy. Fulbright explained, "It is a very serious matter how a country of this importance in the world can make a decision of this kind to go to war." The New Jersey Republican Senator Clifford Case charged that President Johnson, a very political animal, had conducted a campaign of suppression to conceal the true facts of the Tonkin incident. Senator George Sherman Cooper, Republican from Kentucky, told the other senators that if they decided that the country and the Congress were the subject of a giant hoax about the Tonkin Gulf, they might have to demand that the House of Representatives impeach Lyndon Johnson. In his inaugural address following his election in November 1964, on Wednesday, January 20, 1965, President Johnson spoke not a word about Vietnam. He had defeated Barry Goldwater in what was the largest presidential landslide in modern history. Benefiting from his coattails, more Democrats dominated the Senate, 68-38, and the House of Representatives, 295-140, than under any president since Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In his speech, opposite to John F. Kennedy's speech in 1961 at his inauguration, Johnson spoke exclusively of domestic affairs, for his plan to make fundamental changes in American life, with his war on poverty, voting guarantees for all Americans, Medicare, aid to education, and other initiatives that would install the architect of the Great Society in the record books. 3 days after being sworn in, at 2:26 on a Saturday morning, Johnson was hurried by ambulance from the White House to Bethesda Naval Hospital. His wife, Lady Bird Johnson, who had been resting up from the inauguration at Camp David, feared that he had suffered from another heart attack. As she later told her diary, when she arrived at the hospital, she just patted him and sat down and held his hand. "It could have been a frightening day. It was a day I had expected and thought about." Without telling him, Lady Bird Johnson bought a black dress in case she needed one for her husband's funeral. When President Johnson returned to the White House after 3 days at Bethesda Naval Hospital, Lady Bird Johnson told her journal that Lyndon was feeling washed out and depressed. He called Nicholas Katzenbach to ask what the Constitution said about presidential disability, Katzenbach being with the Department of Justice. 8 days after his collapse, Lady Bird Johnson recorded that Lyndon spent most of the day in bed, and for a man of his temperament, it means you have time to worry. She told her diary, "It's sort of a slough of despond. The obstacles, indeed, are no shadows. They are real substance, Vietnam the biggest." His malaise reminded her of William Butler Yeats' poem, The Valley of the Black Pig, written in 1896, which portrayed a desolate man facing a apocalyptic war, stating, "The dews drop slowly and dreams gather unknown spears. Suddenly hurtle before my dream-awakened eyes, and then the clash of fallen horsemen and the cries of unknown perishing armies beat about my ears." Soon, Lady Bird Johnson's fears came to pass. On Saturday, February 6, 1965, the Viet Cong attacked a U.S. Army barracks in Pleiku, killing 8 Americans. That evening, Johnson called Speaker McCormick, Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield, Secretary of Defense McNamara, and other advisors to the Cabinet Room and told him he would order retaliatory airstrikes against 3 North Vietnamese targets. He explained he had kept the shotgun over the mantle and the bullets in the basement for a long time now, but now that they had to act because cowardice has gotten us into more wars than response has. Citing history, Johnson contended that the United States could have avoided both world wars if we had been courageous in the early stages. As Lady Bird Johnson recorded on Sunday, the 7th of January, Lyndon took repeated calls from the Situation Room, stating, "The ring of the phone, the quick reach of it, and tense, quiet talk will probably have to learn to live in the middle of it for not hours or days, but years." Then on Wednesday morning, the 10th, Mac Bundy of the State Department called the president to report that the Viet Cong had attacked a U.S. aircraft maintenance barracks in Quy Nhon, probably using a sabotage bomb. 23 Americans were killed, the most of any single incident yet in Vietnam. Bundy told Johnson that he was reluctant to get in a position that only white men get avenged, but McNamara and I feel very strongly about it. Bundy noted that the North Vietnam had recently attacked train facilities. Therefore, the United States and South Vietnam could together retaliate against a Northern Railroad, an extremely easy target. Afterward, Bundy said, within the next 2 or 3 nights, the president should go on television and coolly and directly offer a full dress account of this affair. Johnson replied that he would not be getting inflammatory or bombastic, but let's proceed. He asked that General William Westmoreland, the U.S. commander in Vietnam, be told to notify captains on aircraft carriers, "Let's just get them to loading their stuff and let's pick the targets." Eager to bring in Congress, Johnson called Speaker McCormick and said, "We've got to meet right quick on targets." The president knew the gravity of the step he was taking. He loped across the street to see his new vice president, Hubert Humphrey, who now occupied the chamber in the executive office building that Johnson had once used when he was vice president, stating, "I'm not temperamentally equipped to be commander-in-chief," telling Humphrey, "I'm too sentimental to give the orders." That evening, after briefing congressional leaders on his planned airstrikes against North Vietnam, Johnson repeated those same words to his wife, Lady Bird, who told her diary, "Somehow I could not wish him not to hurt when he gives the orders." On Friday, Johnson's directive was executed. Seeking reassurance and hoping to thwart Republican opposition, Johnson called former President Eisenhower at his winter home in Palm Desert, California, telling him, I don't want to put it up like we are in deep trouble because I don't think it's reached that point. But you could be more comforting to me now than anybody I know. He asked Eisenhower, "Why don't you come stay all night with me? I'll put you in Abraham Lincoln's bed in the White House." Eisenhower chuckled, "Lincoln's bed?" Johnson offered to send a presidential Jetstar airplane, but cautioned that he did not want the public to think that we've got an emergency or something going on. During his White House visit, former President Eisenhower advised Johnson that if it took 8 American divisions in a campaign of pressure to protect South Vietnam from a communist takeover, so be it. He recalled that we had a long time in Korea. Should China or the Soviets threaten to intervene, Eisenhower went on to say, we should pass the word back to them to take care, lest dire results occur to them. With this, Ike was suggesting a reprise of the hints of nuclear attack that he had quietly dropped in his effort to obtain a Korean armistice when he was president. Eisenhower told Johnson that the greatest danger now would be if China concluded that we will go just so far and no further in pursuing the Vietnam War. At Johnson's request, Eisenhower described how he had conveyed his nuclear threat to the Chinese in 1953 through three channels. Johnson asked how he might convey a similar warning to the Chinese. Eisenhower suggested using the Pakistani president, Mohammad Ayub Khan, a very fine man who he knew from his time in office. Recalling Korea, Johnson asked Eisenhower what to do if Chinese forces crossed the border into Vietnam, requiring 8 or 10 U.S. divisions in response. Eisenhower advised him, should that happen, to hit them at once with air and use any weapons required, including tactical nuclear weapons. He complained that during the Korean War, when he was president, the Chinese believed that Truman had made a gentleman's agreement not to cross the Alu or use nuclear arms. By contrast, in Vietnam, we should let it be known that we are not bound by such restrictions. He warned Johnson that the United States must never allow itself to get over-deployed. Instead, he should hit the head of the snake. With Korea on his mind, Johnson also called former President Truman in Independence, Missouri, stating, I'm having hell. Paternally, the 80-year-old ex-president asked him, what's the trouble? Johnson replied, a little bit with Indochina. I'm doing the best I can. My problem is kind of like what you had in Korea. Eager to charm, he told Truman that he had just looked at the letter he had sent him in June 1950, which said that what you've done is wonderful, and I'm behind you in whatever you do. Johnson reminded ex-President Truman, that was before old Bob Taft got up on the floor and started raising hell about what you ought to have had in a resolution. Truman laughed. Johnson told him, I think when they go in and kill your boys, you've got to hit back. And I'm not trying to spread the war, and I'm not trying, Truman broke in. You bet you have. You bust them in the nose every time you get a chance, and they understand that language better than any other kind. Johnson said, I need your counsel, and I love you. Truman replied, well, that's mutual. Objecting to the president's airstrikes, Democratic Senators George McGovern of South Dakota and Frank Church of Idaho publicly asked him to negotiate with North Vietnam. Furious, Johnson told Mack Bundy of the State Department that neither one of them really fought in many wars or were really outstanding experts in this field. He said those two senators ought to be told what hurts us most is not hitting our compound, but these goddamn speeches that the communists blow up that show they were about to pull out. He asked Bundy to remind the dovish, skeptical Mike Mansfield, senator of Montana, that his president was the old bastard that stays awake every night and send these men to die. of Mansfield, Johnson later moaned, "Why do I have to have a saint for majority leader? Why can't I have a politician?" Senator McGovern went to see President Johnson, who warned him that the North Vietnamese leader, Ho Chi Minh, was a tool of the Chinese. Senator McGovern, who had taught history at Dakota Wesleyan, rejoined that the Chinese had been struggling against the Vietnamese for 1,000 years. By McGovern's later account, Johnson told him, "God damn it, George, you and Senator Fulbright and all you history teachers down there, I haven't got time to fuck around with history. I've got boys in the line out there." Johnson told his old friend Everett Dickerson, the Senate Republican leader from Illinois, that the North Vietnamese can't come bomb us, kill our people, and expect us to go into a cave. To his delight, Senator Dickerson replied that his only mistake had been not to have attacked the North hard enough. Invoking the appeasement of pre-war Nazi Germany, as well as the domino theory, President Johnson replied, "We know from Munich on that when you give, the dictators feed on raw meat. If they take South Vietnam, they take Indonesia, they take Burma, they come right on back to the Philippines." Johnson was outraged to find that his own vice president, Hubert Humphrey, wished to get out of Vietnam. Humphrey wrote him that involvement in a full-scale war would not make sense to the majority of the American people. He conceded that it was always hard to cut losses, but for the newly elected president, 1965 is the year of minimum political risk. As Humphrey later recalled, his letter made Johnson so angry that he threw him into political limbo. Reading from Michael Beschloss's Presidents of War and his essay on Lyndon Johnson in the Vietnam War, will continue. This is Wallace Klinghast, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.